Good evening, everyone. How are you all?
Great.
Good, good. Thanks for coming out. My name is Jeffrey Price, and this is my story. We're headed west, a trip around the world. Before I begin, though, I thought I'd take a minute to get to know all of you a little bit. Can we start with, do we have any natives? Anybody born and raised here their whole lives? Anybody came to visit and they stayed? They just liked it so much they had to stay here? Yeah, we got a few of those. Okay. Anyone never left the country? That was me until 2011. I had never left the U.S., not Mexico, not Canada. I'd never been anywhere. So we have travelers. Everyone here has been around somewhere, left the country?
Yeah.
Europe? Anyone in Europe? Asia?
Yeah.
Africa?
Yeah.
South America? Australia?
Yeah.
All right. Good, good. Good to know. All right. Okay. Well, 545 days, that's today. Today is day 545 of traveling. I started when I was alone. That's when I started counting anyway, which works out to be 24,000 miles around the Earth or 38,000 kilometers because I still have to go back to Denver. So I got another 1,000 miles left to do before I'm completely done. And the other thing I'll be talking a little bit about tonight is El Camino de Santiago, which I was upstairs. I talked to somebody who's a pilgrim. I think I've heard a couple of gals in the audience talking about their experience. So I know I've got a few fellow pilgrims in the room, and that's always exciting. Welcome. But the trouble is, how do you tell a year-and-a-half-long story in an hour? How do you talk about everywhere and everything and everyone you met and the food you ate and the music you listened to from the whole world in an hour? And the truth is, you really can't. That's why we have the question and answers at the end, so that anything you want to know, we have plenty of time for. And in the meantime, if it feels like I'm skipping over a few things, it's because there's simply not enough time to tell it all. So how did I start? I have always felt a call to something greater. As a kid, I wanted to travel around the U.S. I wanted to see the country I live in. I wanted to go all around. And as I got older, I found that it wasn't just the U.S. anymore. I wanted to go see more. This is Grand Tetons, for those of you who've been or who haven't. I'll get more to that later. I did go there as well. But there's just something out there. I knew there was something out there, whether it's a mountain or a plain or a valley or a lake. I knew there was something out there for me to go see, and I wanted to go see what it was. I have a habit of taking the road less traveled. It's a choice I try to make anytime I see a divergence in the path, anytime I have an option laid before me. And I started this trip going 6,000 miles around the western U.S. in this, my 2001 Jeep Wrangler, which was a Colorado custom-built rock crawler designed for the Rocky Mountains. So it was a lot of fun, and actually it ran me over, which was sort of a interesting story in itself. I don't have time to tell much of the whole story, but we'll get into a little bit of it. I started here in Denver. I went up and around 6,000 miles in the western U.S., up to Montana, down to Grand Canyon, Hoover Dam and such, out to San Francisco, Hawaii, Christmas Island, Fiji, around over here through Australia, Ayers Rock in the middle, I got to see that from the plane, and then Bali over here in Indonesia, connection in Manila in the Philippines, flew around to London, bounced around Europe for a while, and then flew across the eastern seaboard down to Florida, and then took another 1,200 miles up to Michigan, where we are here. So there's just this little gap in the middle left that I haven't done. So who am I? If a picture's worth 1,000 words, I think rather than tell myself about you, there's a short video, a little bit about me, who I was before I started this trip, and then some pictures from the trip itself. And I think you'll recognize when the switch is made. Thank you. Okay. So I've always had an appetite for something more, whether it's rock climbing or four-wheel drive or skydiving or bungee jumping. I've kind of had a bucket list over the years, and I'm gradually narrowing it down to the more mundane day-to-day things in life, which I'm looking forward to. So it's kind of the point of it. I told you I got run over. This is that story, that picture. I was switching out an axle on my Jeep when it started rolling down the street. This is real long story short. Managed not to run over the neighbor's car, but in the process it threw me out of the Jeep and ran me over with the back tire through here. So I was kind of hanging on here, went under there, had it roll over my legs, my hips, my chest. And the ER physician was actually quite surprised. He said it's really rare for anyone's chest to get run over and have no broken bones as a result. And it was about 6 inches away from my neck, and all I got to show for it was this little bandage here on my knee. I've got some pretty cool scars from it, but that was the Jeep, that was the front yard, and that was the day I realized that, I want to travel the world, and oh, maybe it's dangerous out there, but it's just as dangerous staying at home. I could just as well get run over in my own front yard as I can getting into trouble around the world, so I might as well risk it and go for it. I started around Colorado. My sister was new to the state, and I wanted to break her out of her emotional funk, if you will. She sort of needed to see the good side in life, and so we spent a whole month just traveling my home state. This is in the Great Sand Dunes National Park. We had the entire campground to ourselves. We drove in over through the mountains into the backside of the sand dunes, Royal Gorge, et cetera, all that. So Colorado, I recommend it. Day one actually started Dinosaur National Monument. This whole region of land is in the northwestern corner of Colorado. It's massive, vast, and sweeping. It crosses many states, many thousands of miles. And just driving through the highway, you can, if you let your imagination run wild with you, it's almost like a Jurassic Park on the side of the highway. It's just, you can really see how creatures this size would have fit into a landscape like this. And I found it a good way to start the trip. It was a geological way to start it. You can see a lot of history. There's a lot of very old, ancient history here. And how better to start opening your eyes to the world than this? So then I went, drove quickly. It was a rather bonsai trip through the U.S. I went to Wyoming. This was cool. Flaming Gorge Reservoir and recreation area in Wyoming. It's very nice, very hot, very boring. Wyoming, they had this conflict monument. So I'd say a war memorial, except that we fought a lot of conflicts that weren't wars, and this town happened to have a monument to every one of them. So I stopped and took a picture there. That's kind of the American countryside for you. Waterfalls were a big thing along the way. This is Hidden Waterfall from Grand Tetons National Park and Upper Yellowstone Falls. I went back to both of these parks. I'd been previously. But again, since I was already in that part of the country, I wanted to see them again. So I did. Yellowstone, if you haven't been, I thought I'd throw in a picture. There's a reason I don't have a lot of photographs of these parks, and there's a reason I don't spend a lot of time telling you secrets or history or things that I really enjoy, because there are volumes of books out there. Yosemite in particular is a man named John Muir. If you ever want to know anything about Yosemite, he's the guy to talk to, so to speak. In Yellowstone, they tell you do not get too close to the wildlife, 100 meters, 100 yards from the grizzly bears, from black bears. I was about 50 yards away when I took this picture and then had a park ranger say, "Hey!" When you're that close to a bear and somebody startles you, it's something you don't forget. But he told me I was too close and I had to back away, and I played dumb. Oh, I didn't know how close I was. Oh, 100 yards. Oh, okay. So we moved back, and I'm glad we did, because sure as we got 100 yards away, this bear was standing at my feet, or where they had been. So it's a good thing we moved, or I might have been lunch. When I left the park, I got this little reminder at a gas station that I'm not out of dinosaur country yet. I kept going. I went up through Montana and Idaho and Salt Lake City, and then down into Moab, Utah, where you might know Arches National Park and Canyonlands National Park. Well, pretty much any and every spaghetti western film ever made in our history has had at least some scenes filmed in Canyonlands National Park. It is the stereotypical American West, and that's why they film their movies there. But they also have this great place called Moab where you can get some of the world's finest four-wheel drive. So I did. I went. This is a route called Fins and Things. I showed up and prepped everything, opened up the top or took off the windows or aired down the tires and released the suspension, all that. And then this guy showed up, and I said, "Hey, it's safer to drive together instead of alone. Do you mind if we tag along?" He didn't mind at all, so the two of us drove through this trail. It was great fun. The Grand Canyon, I think it should be on everybody's bucket list. I've met many a traveler who have talked, oh, I've been to the U.S. Oh, yeah, I went to Grand Canyon, yeah. It seems to be everybody does it, although I don't understand why they always go through the desert. They fly into Los Angeles, and then they go see the Hoover Dam and Las Vegas and the Grand Canyon, and then they go home. They didn't see any lakes or forests or mountains or I don't – so anyway. But Grand Canyon, if you haven't been, I recommend it. I think you should go. It was here that I learned just how small I am in the world. I wanted perspective, and I think this picture says it well because it took me several hours, I think 5 hours to even get towards the park and then another hour to get to take this picture within the park itself. And that whole distance came from somewhere off the map just to that you are here. We're this tiny little dot on this massive canyon. And the drive around the canyon over here to the Hoover Dam is about 8 hours or whatever it was. So it's just massive, and this is one small part of the world. It really kind of helped put the whole thing into size perspective for me. And then I saw the whole American thing. I wanted to see from the Hoover Dam, I went through Las Vegas, and then I went up to the south of California. So I did Barstow and Giant Sequoia National Park and National Forest and Yosemite, which I was there close to 4th of July weekend, which may have altered my experience. I think if it's not as busy, you'll have a better time. I tried to write. Everyone says, oh, did you take a travel book? Do you write anything down? And of course, yes, I do, and I think it's a good thing to do. And I spent quite a bit of time here in Yosemite, looking at this view with my book, finding a different, like a picnic table with my book. And I tried so many different ways to write something beautiful, awe-inspiring, something poetic about Yosemite. And all I could come up with was, it's not the same park that John Muir saw, which is why I recommend you check out any of his stuff if you want to know more about it. But on my way out, I did see another opportunity to see some bear with a little cub right there. And I found that it's difficult to always get pictures. Sometimes I find that the camera doesn't come out fast enough from my pocket, or it's the lighting isn't good enough, or we're driving on the highway and it's blurry. I found those are private moments. There's a reason I wasn't able to take a picture of them. With that said, I tried to get what I could along the way. And then I found the classic American dream. You got the RV, you got the kids, family car, Yosemite Falls. I think that's what they put on postcards. I don't know. But this is interesting. This is the coy wolf, I think. I don't know. I can't confirm that. But I got home after this year and a half documentary, and I found out that there's this this documentary on this new species of coy wolf. It's a crossbreed between coyotes and wolf, and apparently it's becoming a new thing in Yosemite Park. Well, I think driving by, I took a picture of one. I didn't stop because you're not supposed to feed the wildlife, and so I don't know if these people are feeding it or taking their picture, but driving by. So that's cool. I thought, that's a new species. I got a picture of it while I was there. That's nice. From there, I went to San Francisco, kind of barreled through California. Here's Ghirardelli Square on the water, San Francisco Bay for the 4th of July. Checked out Alcatraz Island from the Maritime Museum. They have telescopes you can look through for free. This gal's been before. She knows. So I stuck my camera. It's just my camera phone, but I put it up against the lens, and this is what you can see from there. And there's a lovely garden. It's called Fort Mason. It's an old fort, but they have a garden, Fort Mason Garden. And I spent probably an hour and a half just enjoying the flowers. I think that's a recurring theme I've learned, at least in my life, if not travel, is you have to stop and smell the flowers. So leaving, I went across Golden Gate Bridge, which is, you know, not a big deal because it's not really that big a bridge anymore, but it's fun because now anytime you watch movies and there's some spaceship falling and destroying the bridge, you're like, oh, great, I was there. So that's a fun feeling. I think fireworks are a big part of traveling, and I know they're a part of my personality, my likes, and they were a big part of my travel. This was probably one of the most amazing fireworks shows I've ever seen in my life. They had two separate displays at this location, timed to be the exact same display with music, and they brought in loudspeakers, and so you can see it if you're on this side or on that. You still get a great shot of the show. So if you haven't been, I recommend it. Northern California. I got this far, and now I'm in my Jeep. I'm 6,000 miles later. I'm starting to run out of earth. I know I'm headed west. I thought it'd be romantic to ride off into the sunset and just keep going until I came around again. But I'm starting to run out of earth, so I got to get rid of the Jeep because I can't drive it across the ocean, and now I've got to make up my mind. Up until this point, I don't know where I'm going or when I'm going to be there. Well, it's time to start making some decisions. So while my sister was kind enough to host me with her in California, to get to spend some time on the Russian River, I made these decisions and finally got myself to the airport. I knew I wanted to go to Hawaii. It's been on the bucket list for a long time, so I went. I decided to live there for 3 months. I wanted to know what it was to live there and not to just be a visitor. Although for 3 months, you could still argue I was just a visitor. But I got a new phone at this point because I wanted to take better photos, and then the phone ended up having a software glitch and breaking on me. But it gets great panoramas. This is from Kuli'o'o Ridge on the top. Just gorgeous. And then here's another. This is actually the it's a historic battle site where the two kings and all of their warriors fought until they were chased up this mountain, and these native warriors were here, and they were then cast over the edge of this cliff here, and that's how King Kamehameha became the king of all Hawaii. Not that that's relevant, but a little bit of Hawaii history for you. This was in the Hawaii State Art Museum, which is free, and I think it does a really wonderful job keeping the sense of adventure alive, as well as explaining a whole lot of our history that I think we don't talk about very often, at least not where I'm from. I've had people ask me, like, well, how do you think people in the Pacific got around? Well, a giant exploding volcano in the middle of the night sky is a pretty good indicator that there's something else out there. And so I think that's how they found a lot of what they found. But it's cool. That's a method of boat making that has sort of faded out. People are forgetting how to do that anymore, and it's sad because culturally it's relevant, and I think it's a great design and a great part of our ocean-going history. But here's classic Waikiki. They put this image on the postcards. All these buildings are probably within the last 50 years, which is a little bit sad in its own way, but with the population and vacation explosion, you kind of understand it. Diamond Head down at the end. This was probably my favorite part. I live just 10-minute walk from here. I'd take my surfboard down to the water and surf just to the right and behind where this image was taken. And it's the classic dream. It's Waikiki. It's Hawaii. It's what everybody wants. That's what I wanted to do. This is just off the beach, a gorgeous park. I spent a while writing my book here. I met a guy named Francois, and he was the first kind of real indicator of me helping to help me decide where I was going or what I wanted to do. And that's because he was also his own world traveler. He had come out of France, and he'd gotten this ticket out of London that had him jet-setting around the world. And he and I were talking, and something unfortunate happened, and I said, c'est la vie. And he says, ah, c'est la vie, you know c'est la vie? And I said, yes, I don't speak French, but I know c'est la vie. And he says, I have this picture. So he shows me, it's what's traveling all about? Seeing the culture of other people, having a lot of fun, trying to find the meaning of life, jig-jig many time, get drunk, confused, c'est la vie. And he said, Jeff, what do you think jig-jig many time means? And I said, well, the Irish dance a jig. I think it's a dance, you know, you got to dance a lot. And he says, yeah, sure. So from there, I figured it out. I bought my tickets. He invited me to go with him to Fiji, Bali, Australia, and Thailand, some of which I did, some of which I didn't. Christmas Island, from Hawaii to Fiji. If you can imagine California on one side and Japan on the other side of the Pacific Ocean, with Midway being halfway, and then Hawaii just a little bit closer to home than that. And if you go 3 hours south into the middle of the water where there's absolutely nothing else around, you'll find Christmas Island, where I was a little bit sad at first because I wanted to get out and touch the soil. And maybe that's just me or peculiar or whatever, but I wanted to touch the soil. I didn't know when I'd ever get a chance to be back, and we couldn't because if we were going through, you had to stay on the plane. Well, then, 3 hours into the flight, we get an announcement. This is your captain speaking. We've had some difficulties with the plane. There's a problem with the APU. We are letting you know that everything is fine, but we will be turning around to Christmas Island. We will not be going on to Fiji. Sorry for the inconvenience. Well, it turns out the auxiliary power unit was out, so we could have very well filmed our own version of Castaway had he not turned around. It was really nice because we had to stay here at the Captain Cook Hotel that the airline paid for, and I got to touch the dirt. So that was it was great. This is an amazing place. It's way out in the middle of nowhere. I've got way more stories to tell about it, even though I was only there one night, than I have time to tell you about now, but I will give you a picture of sunrise before we get on the plane the next morning. From there, I'll take you to the sunrise on Fiji. We had to hike up this, it's not a mountain really, it's a hill, island hill, on Mana Island. And at the top is this cross, and we waited for the sunrise to come up. And the sun was partially hidden by the clouds, but it was still a nice view nonetheless. And then we turned around, had to walk back down, and this was our island. When people go to Fiji, they fly into the mainland, but then you're there for the islands. That's why people usually are there for the. That's what's beautiful about it. So we walked down the hill here. Villagers and islanders lived here. Our hostel was about here. There was another one down here. Down this way is a real expensive resort, and there off on the tip is like the honeymoon suite. I have no idea how ridiculously expensive that is. But on the other side of that is the most amazing snorkeling over there. We spent days on that, and I think that's where they got the idea for Finding Nemo. I mean, I know it's based in Australia, but I feel like I more than lived the movie by snorkeling on this island. I felt like it was more beautiful and had so much more than even the movie could offer, and it was in real life. So Fiji, I mean, that's why everybody, you can surf there, it's the dream thing, that's why Fiji. So people say, why'd you go? Well, it's Fiji. This is the other side of Fiji, on the mainland, that people don't know about. Most people fly into Nandi, and the other big town that everyone knows, or most people know, is Suva. And so this is probably three, four hours outside of Suva on the west coast. I was with some fellow pilgrims, fellow travelers, and we had stayed on the resort on Mana Island, and now we had time before we were supposed to fly out, but not a lot of money, and didn't know how we were going to pay to stay or eat or survive. And some kind employee that worked there said, oh, you can stay with my family. They're on the other side of the island, and it took us like 9 hours by a little passenger van. It was supposed to only hold 10. There was about 15 of us in it. I know what sweaty sardines feel like now. But this was their house. They built it themselves. It's just tin siding. They can open it up for nice ventilation. It's got running water, but no power. The shower is ice cold. Gorgeous little place. Really helped me to appreciate what we have in life and the simple things, and how it helped me learn that the people who have the least tend to be the happiest and share the most. I don't know. Any time I've ever gone anywhere, I find that the less people have, the happier in life they are. The more they laugh, the more they smile, the more they tell jokes, the more they're willing to share their dinner with you. Even if they're poverty themselves, they'll share everything with you, and they'll do it with a smile on their face. This was sunrise from that house. Just gorgeous. And then every boy's country paradise, the swimming hole. We went down to the harbor to go for a little bit of a swim, and then we came back to see a man about some fish so we could have some dinner. And on the way back, we stopped for some water where there was a swimming hole. So you can maybe see one of the boys there on the other side standing on the rocks. It's quite large, and we played a lot of games for several hours. The girls here are dressed in their Sunday best because we did in fact go to church while we were there. This was the view from the church. This is the west side of the island looking south. Green, untouched, pure, organic food grows on the side of the road, usually tiny little really spicy peppers that most people choose not to eat anyway, but if you want it, you wouldn't go hungry. There's always food growing on the side of the road. The most amazing sunset was Fiji, and it was not this picture. This is another one of those moments where life just removes the camera from it. It's one of those. So I was lucky enough to get this picture, but this went on for hours. It started out as a blue, boring, mundane sky with some gray clouds, and it morphed into this, and for an hour and a half, I just was speechless watching it change. Then I went on to Bali. I met up with Francois. This is almost 6 months later. We went to the Sacred Monkey Forest in Ubud. So we got pretty close with the family. They're pretty friendly. They like food until they stop having a good time, and then they get pretty cheeky. They start playing games with you and trying to steal your keys, and then it's time to leave. And Bali is a really textured country, and I don't think there are words enough to describe it. It is layer after layer of texture upon texture. And this, we just happened to be on the way back driving our scooter on the way back from the Sacred Monkey Forest, and we stopped for pork, of all things. Francois wanted spit-fired pig. Roasted pig. So we stopped. They didn't have the one he was looking for, but this was on the side of the bridge, the statue here. And there's just so much texture to it. And then you have the rice paddies all terraced up the side of the hill. And it was just gorgeous. He met some French gals in Australia while he was surfing there, and they had come to Bali, and this is what they painted on the side of their wall, which is, the world is a book, and those who don't travel read only one page. Don't take life too seriously. No one gets out alive. Home is wherever you are. If you are not barefoot, you are overdressed. People don't take trip. Trip take people. This is your life. Do what you love and do it often. Now, I don't know that I would prescribe this to everyone or anyone, or if all of them apply or don't. But it's nice to know that fellow travelers have these lofty ideals, and they are free to share them with you. And if you come across, you can open yourself up to them. Dream as if you'll live forever. Live as if you'll die tomorrow. You can't control the waves, but you can learn to surf them. I haven't been everywhere, but it's on my list. And an oldie but a goodie, you've got to dance like there's nobody watching, love like you will never be hurt, sing like there's no one listening, and live like it's heaven on earth. There's just not enough time in this life for regrets or mistakes or wishing we could have or should have. It's just the choices we make moving forward. Before I left Bali, we had one more lunch with Francois, with Buddha, in more rice fields. Pretty natural. There were these really gorgeous white, I'm not sure if I can get the mouse on there. There we go. White, like, I think they were crane, just filling this field. And it was gorgeous to just sit there and quietly watch lunch with them. From there, we went to Malta. This is a girl named Christine. I met her on the 4th of July in San Francisco, where I didn't spend that holiday with but a single American. There were a dozen Australians, some New Zealanders, a Polish guy, this Maltese gal, a couple of French, and only one Native American. Well, not Native American, but he's an American by the name of Francisco from San Francisco. But anyway, Christine here, she told me, if you ever go to Europe, you must come to Malta. I live in Malta. This is my country. You must come. I will show you. Okay. So I went. It's gorgeous. They build everything out of limestone because the island itself is made out of limestone. And so they have these massive quarries and all their buildings. They have this old architecture, and it's very beautiful, lots of flowers everywhere. It's probably the best-kept secret of Europe. If you're going to go there. I went there in the beginning of January. And it's as far south as you can be in Europe while still being in Europe, except maybe Greece. So in January, when it's supposed to be cold, it's a good place to be. This is the harbor. They have three forts. This newer one here in the middle, the older one in the back, and another newer one way out front in the panorama down below. This is a ceremonial firing of the cannon, because they want to honor those that they have lost to the service. Malta has a very old history, Middle Ages at minimum. They have the Knights of Malta going back to 1200, so their history is much older than that even. But it's very gorgeous, and I recommend going to see it. If you're going to go to Europe, go to Malta. This is the Azure Window. It's massive. It's 270, 330 feet tall, 100 meters almost. And if for the brave, they can walk up on top of it and get their picture taken. That's one thing. And for the other, they can go down here right at water's edge. If the tide comes in, you're going to start swimming. And I don't recommend it because there's a lot of rocks. It's pretty dangerous. But if it's low tide, like it happened to be, you can get a pretty good picture. And the food, these are like a green bean or a pea, split pea, and this is cream cheese. These are Maltese pastries. They're about 30 cents, not American cents, but euros, cents on the euro. And the coffee. Normally we didn't drink coffee out of a glass. Europeans usually have a cafe espresso, but if you're local, it's like 30 cents each. So a euro for this whole breakfast meal. It was lovely. As an American, they usually charge me more than that, 60 cents, 80 cents. But it's still really, really good, inexpensive food. It does tend to make you a bit fat, but if you're walking around, it doesn't matter. So this is another shot from Malta. This is on the south side. It was a warm, sunny, beautiful day, and we got down right on the water's edge, and it kind of took my breath away a little bit. It was one of those moments where I just stop, you look around, kind of raise your eyes towards the sky, and you just realize that I am here on this part of the earth right now. And that was one of those moments. It just kind of reminded me of where I was. The salt flats, ancient salt flats, these salt beds, they let the seawater in, and then the sun evaporates it, and they've been collecting salt this way, natural sea salt, for hundreds of years. And this is, again, Christine showing me another part of the island, a great panorama. You can see the rock quarry in the back here. Right on the edge of the water, it's beautiful blue Mediterranean, very flat, very calm. And again, this is another panorama of that second fort down on the end on the left there, and then all of the cityscape and living quarters that goes with it. And then where I'm actually is on the pier of the first fort with all of the living that goes with that. So there's just a lot to it. But you can see everything you need to see in the whole island in 3-4 days tops. Here's another part of the island. Another limestone building, very old church, very large, and this very stereotypical Maltese landscape. Very large cactus. Each one of these petals or leaves is the size of my head, and many of these plants are 6-7 feet tall. Beautiful green fields, old limestone, limestone architecture and clear blue skies. That's Malta in a nutshell. From there, I went to Italy. Lots of stories on getting there on the in-between, but this is in Italy, in Naples. This is one of the local forts with my local Napoli gal showing me around. She's a lovely Italian. She spoke some English. It's a great city. There's great food on every street. There's always these little carts they'll put out covered in glass, and for €1 or €2, you can get anything fresh baked that morning. It's all cooked locally, grown locally. It's wonderful food. I think we should do it here. I don't know why we can't figure it out, but we can't. From there, I got to play with my widescreen again. This is Galleria Umberto. Umberto is an Italian name. So how do I explain what it is other than something tourists go see? It's, in the American sense of the word, it's a shopping mall, but I think an Italian might punch me in the eye for calling it that, because they're Italian and this is much more classy than any shopping mall I've been to. It's all hand-polished, hand-carved stone, whether it's on the floor or the buildings, and then Italian glass, and it's just massive. Really, really beautiful. They're all, I think originally they were narrow streets, and then they built a glass coverway so they could enjoy their shopping, street shopping in cold weather, in winter. This is the dome, the cathedral, the dome. Il Duomo is called the dome. Absolutely gorgeous in Naples. I wish I had more time there. I got inside for a little bit. This was a great shot. That dome is so large and so masterfully painted, and the way that it's been designed to allow the light in, and the way the light fills it, and then you have the whole altar and the way it's lit up, and then the whole space, it always draws your eyes up. And I knew very well that that was one of the things I wanted to see about going to Europe. I knew that we, here in the States, we just don't have old enough churches. We don't have old architecture. Not in this sense, not in the 1200 years old, which was everywhere there, all hand-painted by the masters and gilded and just absolutely gorgeous. And so I'm really grateful for that part of the trip. Spiritually, I know maybe this is not my prescribed thing, maybe that's not the book I read, whatever everyone's particular standpoint is, but either way, it's still easy to walk in there and appreciate the beauty and the artwork of it. Here's again from Naples. This is Mount Vesuvius in the back. It's been a lifelong goal to see Mount Vesuvius. So there it is. This was the old fort, as well as it's now a royal museum next to the even larger fort where all the troops were stationed. It's kind of a royal housing. They have all their old carriages, and the actual king and queen's throne from such a century are there in this museum, and a great view of the Bay of Naples. Then from there I went on to Rome. Saw the Colosseum, of course, you have to. I found that any major city, you only really need 2 nights to see it. One night to arrive, the next morning I would get up here in Rome, for instance, and I walked on foot for 9 hours to go walk around the town. They give you the tourist map. Oh, I did a circle all the way down and around, checked it all out, St. Peter's Basilica, in 9 hours. So it's doable. And then you sleep and you get on with your life and you go to the next town. But if you want museums and all that and fine dining, then probably spend some more time. But the old Roman ruins, they're just massive. You can see tiny little blips of people, and then way out there in the background, they're almost just a pixel. They're so small. So it gives you some perspective of how big these ruins are. And then again, you've seen the Hawaii panoramas, so you know the amount of image that you can get into one. And I get halfway through the outside periphery, and then I've just barely got the St. Peter's Basilica, and then there's not even a chance of fitting that on. Otherwise, vertical, you just lose so much depth. But it was far larger than I ever would have imagined. You got tiny little people, this full-size bus, and it's still just dwarfed in comparison. I had no idea it was that big in real life. From there, Pisa, the Leaning Tower, of course, everyone knows. I didn't include pictures of the church or the baptistry because I just like this picture. It's green grass and blue sky, and I spent a lot of time in the rain. So I'm happy to have a blue shot. You may remember from the video, there's one of me holding on to it, and I wasn't going to do it. First of all, I'm traveling, I'm alone. Second of all, everyone knows what a selfie is and how there's this snafu or public taboo about taking too many selfies. So I don't want to be the American guy taking a selfie with the Pisa. But I took a picture of just me in the tower, and my sister, that wasn't good enough. She said, "What are you doing, Jeff?" I said, "What do you mean? I took the picture, I'm standing with it, it's good enough." She said, "No, why aren't you holding it up?" I said, "Because it's cliche, everyone does that." She says, "I don't care, I want to see it." Okay, fine. So that's why I gave her the picture. And then she was right, of course, because all my friends like that picture far more than they like the other ones. I tell you again about those roads, these decisions, these paths, splits in the path that we have to take. or choose. And Europe was a great example of one. This is an image taken in the botanical gardens of the University of Naples. But by the time I got to Pisa, it was very much a real-world practice of that concept of choosing a path, because I was in Pisa and I had to decide whether to go west or east. If I went east, it meant Eastern Europe, which I had no idea about. I understood it was cheaper, but I also understood that in some areas maybe it's a little more dangerous. But I don't know what the transportation's like or anything. I didn't know anything about it. And I knew that I could potentially go there and run out of money and be stuck in Eastern Europe without money, and that didn't sound good. Or I could go west into the Pyrenees and do a little bit of work away, it's called. So it's not paid work, but it's a good way to just chill out and not spend any money for 2 weeks. So that's what I did, and that helped me make that decision. But here, I had to stop. I put everything down. I took this picture, and I realized that Robert Frost must have seen something just like this. And as I read the poem and I looked at the picture together, I just felt like this must have been the thing he saw, although I'm pretty sure it wasn't. I'm sure he was on the East Coast, New England. But two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference. It really has. All throughout my life, from a kid to an adult to traveling the world, taking the road less traveled has always served me well. So from there, I also went to go see Monaco. I don't know what trip is complete without it. You know, you always hear the Grand Prix. Everybody knows Grand Prix. Yeah, okay, I walked on the streets where they have the Grand Prix. Okay, everybody knows about the multi-million dollar mega yachts. And I actually met a guy. I've got a friend. He works on one of them now. But I had no idea how big these things were or how well-detailed or how immaculate and just amazing they are until I saw them up close. But you have Monte Cassino. So I went. I gambled in Monte Cassino. I lost $20. But it was $20 that I paid for the story. Now I can say I've gambled in Monte Cassino. Nice, France, especially here, I'll draw your attention, the old town, the old quarter, the historic city. This is where the royalty and the rich of all of Europe for hundreds of years and all throughout the Middle Ages have escaped the winter doldrums of living in Northern Europe. And they run south. This is about as far south as you can go until you start getting into Italy, which is far enough. You've gone far enough, believe me. But they used to go there, and they would celebrate, and they would relax, and they would celebrate warm weather, or the warmest they could get in February during Carnival that they could not have in the north. And they would celebrate Carnival here, which they've done for hundreds of years by throwing a big parade and having lots of food. And the market's actually right here in this old historic center. And I had a friend that was nice enough to put me up in one of these real nice luxury kind of retired living. It was nice. Nice, France. It's a little bit weird because the beach is not sand, it's stone. And so that's a little bit different for most people, but it's still very lovely. I still swam in it. I recommend you do. Notre Dame. I went to Paris. I spent 10 hours again walking by foot in Paris, and then the sun had gone down, and I was looking at the Arc de Triomphe in the dark, and so I finally got on the subway. I didn't walk the rest of the way home because that was far enough. But this is the famous bridge of the Lock of Love. All of these are padlocks. All of these, somebody who loves somebody came and locked it away, or they came together and they wrote their name on it. And it's supposed to be that one of them's got the lock, one of them's got the key. They lock it on the bridge, throw the key over into the river, and they lock away their love for all time. And so this has got to have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of locks on it by now. And I spent a great long time here just watching people riding, whatever, enjoying the view of Notre Dame. And I've always heard of this in movies and stuff, but I'd never been, so I always wanted to go. Checked out the Louvre. I didn't pay for any museum, so I didn't go inside the Louvre. Everyone thinks it's a catastrophe. I didn't go, but I'm sure they're right. But sometimes when you got to decide if you're going to eat that night or pay for a museum admission, you got to pick the food. I kept walking around. I saw the Eiffel Tower in the distance. I took a nice shot of it crossing this river where there was a couple standing there getting ready to kiss, and she was saying something. I overheard her telling him, oh, we should stay here and watch the sunset go down over the river. And I thought to myself, I can make it there before that sun goes down. And sure enough, I did. Took a picture of it at night. You can do anything you put your mind to. Rapidly, I'm leaving out all of Normandy, which I feel is a shame. I was there for the 70th anniversary of D-Day, so I saw tanks and paratroopers and trucks and costumes and the whole works. Fireworks shows. I've been to St. Mary Glees, Carentan, the whole works. That was an honor and a privilege that I can't even begin to describe. But unfortunately, there's just so much to say, and I don't really have Normandy in here. But this is the Netherlands, Holland. I did go up and see the old windmills as well as the new. the water, the green fields, Amsterdam, Noordwijk. I spent 3.5 days on the Netherland beach. That was a lovely way to spend. It was from Fiji and Bali. I was done with the cold European winter thing. I wanted warm weather, so I went to the beach. A little town called Leiden. That was all fun. Went back through Paris and went to go see a friend, Francois, again. It's been about 6 months since I've seen him in Bali. So I went to Tonnes-les-Bains, which is on Lake Geneva, on the French and Swiss border, in the Alps. And this is actually called the Via Ferrata. It's called that because it's the metal way. They put these metal bolts and handles in and cables into the mountain itself, and then you're able to clip in and safely climb up the mountain. It's much easier than rock climbing if you're out of practice or out of shape or out of condition, and just as intimidating, I think. But gorgeous, gorgeous views, very rewarding. The French Alps, being on the side of this cliff with naturally glowing, growing French Alp flowers with this view made it worth the trip. I'm going to gloss over the Camino. In between that last picture and this one, I went on the Camino, but I'll come back to that. This is Porto in Portugal. I then did a reverse Camino from Santiago down to, it's supposed to go to Lisbon, but I went to Faro. So this is Porto, where port wine gets its name. I can honestly say it's an honor and a privilege to have drank port wine, Porto, in the city of Porto, on the Golden River during sunset with golden rays of light coming down over the old city. You can see the ancient architecture of the city as well as just the old, several hundred year old. It's not really old to them. This is the old thing, more than 1,000. But that was a great day. Met some lovely people. We had a make-your-own sandwich dinner with port wine right on the river. One of them was a guitar player. We sang songs, had music. It was a great time. From there, I went to Fatima. This is Fatima, where they've built this massive cathedral. This is actually a pilgrim's cathedral, because 60 years ago, and I may not get the story entirely correct, but I'll try for you. 60 years ago, three boys were out in the woods when they had this angel come to them and give them this message in the wilderness out of this bush or this tree, and they went back to tell the village about it, and there was this whole big thing about how they kind of thought the boys were lying or making it up, and then it was such a religious experience for these Portuguese people that they built this cathedral, and now you have a mass pilgrimage every year. I was lucky enough to get there in between when it wasn't so crowded, but then the day after I left Fatima, I saw on the news the very next day, swarms, had to be 100,000 people minimum, swarms. And this place is massive. It was filled elbow to elbow, just people everywhere. So it's pretty popular to be a pilgrim in Portugal. Not the Camino type of pilgrim, though, because I found frequently that any town I stayed in, I was the only pilgrim in that town, which was far different from Spain. But I think if you needed to know what Portugal was in a nutshell, this church sums it up. It was closed. I didn't even go in this church. It was boarded up and closed, and it looked like somebody kind of checks up on it a while to make sure it's not falling down, but otherwise it's not used. But it was just gorgeous and part of the Portuguese countryside. So the Camino. I keep talking about the Camino. What is this Camino? We have 15 minutes, which is not nearly enough to tell you about the Camino, but I'll try. And then I had somebody asked me, well, Jeff, didn't you run into any trouble? Didn't you have any hard times, or wasn't anything difficult for you during all of this? And of course, many times. And at the end, there was a particular situation in Portugal where I was having some difficulty. And I told that story to someone, and she asked me if I had any pictures of it. And I said, no, I think that's another one of those moments where the camera's just not there for that. But I went through everything, and I found one picture that you'll see at the very end of that story. So that might have to go into questions if you're interested to hear that story, but I'll show you that picture when we're done. So this is the Caminos. These are the Caminos of Santiago. They come from every country in Europe. It's more than 1,000 years old, at least it's been written. There's a lot of people that would tell you that before it was put into writing, there were many people unwritten doing this travel. But whether you're coming from Denmark or the UK or Poland or Italy, these are the different routes that come into Spain, where they all become one, and then 800 kilometers or 500 miles from the border between France and Spain across the north of the country into Santiago de Compostela. So having come up through Italy and Naples and Rome and Pisa, I was traveling along this Camino for a while. And then having gone to Amsterdam, I was traveling along this Camino for a while. And then having gone to Tonnes-les-Bains on the Lake Geneva, I was following this Camino for a while. And then I actually started in Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, just on the French side of the border there. Better map of the Spanish portion of the Camino. Roncesvalles was the first town in Spain. It's 27 kilometers from Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, and it's the first town in Spain. It's the big deal. If you make it here, I think you'll be just fine. Burgos has a very large cathedral. León has another one. Sobrero is an important part. Santiago's at the end. A couple of the artistry things you'll see along the way. Anyway, what is it? It's a pilgrimage. People have, for hundreds of years, millions of people have gone here for spiritual reasons or personal reasons, or they want to quit smoking, or they are having trouble with letting go of the death of a loved one, or whatever their own particular burden in life is. People will often go and do the Camino for healing, or maybe they just like walking holidays. But how do you do it? You walk. You could walk. You could ride a bicycle, or you could take a donkey, or you could walk while your dog takes a donkey. I saw this guy on the trail. I asked him in my best Spanish if I could take his picture. He said it was okay. So he's the only guy on the trail I saw with a donkey. We did see a couple other donkeys along the way, but it's not very commonly used. So this was good fun. I was glad to take his picture. This was the first day on the way, 27 kilos for 27 kilometers, 60 pounds for 17 miles, up and over the Pyrenees mountain range. This was my bag in the first day in the driving rain and freezing rain and sideways rain and straight down rain and soft rain and heavy rain and cold rain and wet rain. We had every kind of wet rain and cold and fog and misery and lightning on this mountain that you could hope to never run into. There were piles of hail from the day before where it had just been hailing thunderously. I had heard stories of people got trapped in the hail. They had to come back down into the shelter and get out of it because they were suffering bruises from it. Why 60 pounds? Why on earth? Well, I'd gone around the world, and I didn't know what I'd need, but I owned a lot of stuff. So instead of having to buy something I already owned along the way, I just kind of took way too much with me. I probably had 500-600 pounds worth of gear in the Jeep. And to be down to 60 pounds of everything I own in the world on my back was still not light enough. It was causing me a lot of problems. Muscles, bones, cartilage, ligaments, tendons, they were all suffering. So this is on top of the mountain, 9 miles in. I ran out of water at one point. It was 4.5-5 miles in, ran out of water. Somebody gave me a liter, liter and a half water. There's a water fountain on top. Kim took this picture of me. She fed me some Snickers, and her friend, he gave me a pack of Marlboro Reds and Snickers and water, and that got me through the next 10 miles to get into town, where I immediately set about making the bag lighter. But you'll see this is the marker along the way. This is how you know you're going the right way. There's a movie called The Way. Emilio Estevez made it. Martin Sheen is in it. This is maybe this most infamous woman in Spain. She is wonderful for all things Camino, and she did a lot of work with Martin on the movie. But this gal here, she actually works at this building, and on the second morning, I had to coordinate a few things, and I talked to her a little bit in the morning, and I took this picture. If you haven't seen it, I recommend you see it. It's here at the library. You can take it home with you. It's a really great way, a Hollywood American way of telling the story, of helping someone understand what is the Camino. And it's 2 hours, and I think it still barely scratches what is the Camino. But it's great. And I've seen it before. It was actually my inspiration to know how I wanted to go on the way. I thought, how have I never heard of this before? I have to do this. Well, I didn't do it right away. It took me a number of years. But when I finally decided to travel the world, I decided to go west, partly due to that way by the time I got around the world again, I could do the Camino at the end and reflect on all that I had learned and seen and done. So right after taking that picture and leaving that building, Santiago de Compostela, 790 kilometers away. Have fun. Good luck. Don't stop walking. There was not a road anywhere near the sign. It was just dirt path in the middle of the woods. But I thought it was encouraging and funny both. And then you pass on to the next mountain range with windmills on the top. They're very good about their natural power over there in Europe. This particular set of mountain range, my boots, at this point, they weren't the highest quality to begin with, but they were ultra lightweight. And now they're a year old and heavily used, so they're falling apart, and my feet are so swollen that even with the laces all the way undone, my feet cannot fit into my boots. Well, I had Birkenstocks or flip-flops, so I hiked up and over this mountain in Birkenstocks. If you got to do it, you got to do it. So at the top of this mountain, they have this monument, these flat pieces of metal to let you know you're a pilgrim and you're on the way. And it's very encouraging and it's beautiful, and I got my picture taken there. This is St. James himself, the statue of St. James.
Y desde aquí todos los caminos a Santiago se hacen uno solo.
It is here that all of the ways of the Camino become one. So this is the marker. This is where all those trails, all the other routes on the other map come together into just one route. And in that town where this statue is this lovely building. These birds are 3-4 feet tall, at least. Their nests are probably 5-6 feet across. They're well up on top of these buildings. It's pretty cool. You can't see them that great on this picture, but they're a really great part of Spain. The next morning, looking back into the town I just left, sunrise is a common theme on the Camino. I am frequently up before the sun, and then I will turn around and look at it as it rises behind me. So this was a gorgeous town, a very famous bridge or infamous bridge, a very old pilgrim's bridge. I think it's got to be 600 to 900 years old. And it's nice to know that millions of people have walked exactly right there. And then some Camino road shows. And now this is where I'm going to speed up just a little bit, so I hope that's not too much of an issue. If a picture's worth 1,000 words, I think each one will say a lot, even if I don't say anything about them. I tried not to take too many pictures. I think I failed. But on the Camino itself, it was supposed to be kind of just my private thing. I wasn't really going to take that many pictures. But to give you an idea of how vast it is and how much trail you're on and just some things along the way, I met a guy doing a Camino project. He had a camera guy and a sound guy, and he was the producer. And he asked me if he could take my portrait. And in his Camino project he was working on, he was taking portraits of people and landscapes, and so sometimes he'd use them independently, and sometimes he would actually merge people's faces into a landscape shot. And then sometimes he would have video interviews or video views of scenery or whatever it was, and so he asked if he could take my portrait, and I said, sure. So he asked if black and white was okay, and I said, hey, you're the producer. So it was nice. It was nice to have a proper portrait at least once somewhere on the travel. And people like to ask me, Jeff, why did you decide to grow a beard? I said, well, I didn't decide to grow a beard. I decided to stop shaving, and this is the consequence. Well, why would you not want us to shave? Well, it's heavy to carry around. If it's electric, you got to be able to plug it in and have an adapter and find a plug. If you're shaving, you've got to have shave cream, and it's a mess, and maybe it'll explode in your bag or the airport or whatever. Plus, you're cutting your face open, and then you're going to go scuba diving in Hawaii or snorkeling in Fiji, and you've got this open cut on your face. You're going to risk that infection by having an open wound? No, I think I'll just grow the beard and stop carrying around extra stuff. Thank you. From there, we went to Burgos. The only shot of this entryway I have, this is a very famous entryway into Burgos. All the pilgrims come across this bridge and this probably about 800-year-old gateway into the town. Used to be the town's fortification to defend from invaders. Just gorgeous. An oasis in the desert. It can get quite hot out there on the Camino, so I took a moment to take this picture of this amazing place that I was thankful that they put some water and chairs. You can have a barbecue. If you're camping, you're going to sleep out under the stars. I recommend staying here. There's plenty of places along the way if that's your thing. My pack, 60 pounds to, or 20, it was 27 kilos down to maybe 12 to 15 kilos, depending on how much water I was carrying. So I've 30, 35 pounds maybe, I don't know. Still far too much. Everybody else, they say you're supposed to only have 10, 15% of your body weight. So this is way more than that. But I let go of 10 kilos worth of stuff, and then I still had all this stuff, and I just didn't want to let go of any more of it. So that was my pack, and I was happy with it. People asked, did you meet anyone along the way? Of course I did. I met loads of people. This is the only American in the shot. This guy's from Norway. These two are from South America. I think Peru and Chile, maybe. This guy is from Denmark, and then this guy is from Spain, but he's been in university in Paris for 5 years, so he was telling all the girls he was French. And it worked. You know, hey, if you speak French. This lovely Swiss couple, maybe the nicest people I met, she spoke French, Spanish, and English at minimum. He spoke French and English. Just gorgeous people. They were doing it for their father. When he was a young man, he had traveled for 18 months around Europe and Africa on a bicycle. And he is now, or at the time, was in the hospital very sick, and they wanted to complete the Camino for his sick father in honor of him and in memory of his travels. And they wanted to finish while he was still with them. And so they interviewed me here this day. They actually said, hey, we like your story so much. At this point, I've been traveling more than a year. They said, we like your story so much. Can we interview you? We'd like to do a video interview and send it to our father in the hospital. We think he'd really appreciate it. So that was one of what turned out to be three interviews I had on the Camino, of which I'm not sure anything will ever become of it. But it was fun. It was interesting. And I was honored and touched that I could be a part of somebody else's life, somebody I'd never even got a chance to meet. Sunrise again, coming up. This is out of town. We hiked this massive hill. You can't hardly see it in the dark, but it is just massive. And then it comes up again over the hill. Sunrise was just a big thing. Almost out of time now, so I'm going to kind of fly. Churches were a big thing. There's a church in every town on the Camino. It was a lovely way for me to be able to pray. Even if I'm not Catholic, I just found enjoyment in going into the church, appreciating the space for what it is, and having my own private space for my own reflections. Your shadow's quite long at 4 in the morning or 5 in the morning. But you know you're going the right way. You're always chasing your shadow. You know you'll come home again. And flowers, again, you've got to stop and smell the roses, smell the flowers in life. With another church in town, another sunrise coming up. And again, in the middle of your bare nothingness of just brown and flat, you'll get this reminder that you're doing something right. You have these massive, beautiful fields of sunflowers. Here we are in Terra Dios de los Templarios with the land of the Templar Knights. So we stayed there. Here's another and maybe the most important sunrise. After this, there were not any other sunrises that could compare. I was watching them every day, every sunset, every sunrise along the way that I had the chance. And this one, there just wasn't anything else like it. After this, there was no sunrise that it could compare. This is the cover image. If you have a Camino book, I think this is the picture that sums it up. El Camino de Santiago in stone. That's just very good. The halfway point, we got there, we didn't even know it. You got the scholar on the left and the warrior on the right. Spring I found out of the ground. Everybody else just walked past. I was like, hey, look, fresh water. I wanted to drink it, but the girls wouldn't let me. this is the cathedral in Burgos and the interior of what's not the cathedral in Burgos because they charged to get in, so I didn't pay. I went to a different church down the road that was free and much more beautiful on the inside, I think. Another sunrise along the way. Got into Lyon. Found another few old churches. Flowers along the way again. They're just everywhere, of every color and shape and size. This is the Iron Cross. It's on top of the last set of mountains you go. The Camino for some is to carry a stone from your home in your pocket. And you carry this burden with you, and on the trail you have it in your pocket so you can feel it, the weight of it in your pocket, in your hand. You can take it out and carry that weight, whatever it is that you haven't let go of in life. Loss of a family member, whatever it is, whatever that burden is that you can't seem to let go of, you carry it here, and you drop it on this pile, which when this first started, this was flat. There was no hill there. There was no pile. But over hundreds of years, millions of people have put their stones until it's taller than a person. It's just massive. And the day I arrived here was a Thursday, the day of the Feast of St. James, and I was flying up this mountain. I was skipping, I was running, I was hopping and jumping. People are like, whoa, what's up with you? Well, I got here and I realized it's because I was getting rid of my burden. Mentally, I'd already gotten rid of it that morning. It was just the physical act of waiting until I could put it in the pile. So after that, I felt great. A friend was kind enough to take this picture for me. Just decided the trail wasn't it. That sometimes you have to step outside the normal bounds of life and enjoy it from a different perspective. So that's what I did. And I walked a while in this hayfield just to enjoy it. This is encouragement, reminding you that it doesn't have to be depressing. Come whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving. Ours is not a caravan of despair. Even if you have broken your vow 1,000 times, come yet again, come. Which is kind of depressing. I think we were all in a much happier place than that. But if you're still sad at that point, I guess that's encouraging. It's a beautiful view of the mountains again. We had a cattle drive right down the middle of our trail. Local guy just taking his cattle out for a walk. This is the top of Osobrero, very old church. This is it. It's all downhill. It's almost over. You know, you're almost in Santiago. The credential. They took my picture here. It's not full in the picture, but I've got it here tonight with me, and it is full. I'll be happy to show you in questions and answers. Take a look. I've got my Compostela, my completion as well. A few other things for you to look at if you're interested in. Another Camino pilgrim friend. She lost her shell. I noticed on her bag she didn't have her pilgrim shell anymore. And I, you got to stop and take a look, right? So we stopped, I took my bag off, and I went running for it. Just thought I'd see if it happened to be somewhere reasonably close where we could pick it up and not have lost it forever. Well, so she picked my bag up, unbeknownst to me, and carried it into the shade, and her sister took this picture. So I thought it was pretty good. She kind of, it's all sweaty. She realized that was a mistake. But here it is, in writing. We're at the end. It's the cathedral. It's got scaffolding on it because they had just done, for the Feast of St. James, that previous Thursday, a massive fireworks display in which they are in very real jeopardy of burning down the building, even though it's made out of stone. So rather than burning their building, they put up this scaffolding, and then they have this black and white recreation of what the exterior looks like, and then they basically burn down the building. I mean, I wasn't there for it, but I understand the fireworks show in this building just makes you think the whole town's going to catch on fire. It's really good, apparently. So there we are at the finish. There's the town, Santiago de Compostela. This is my Compostela. It's, if you do it for religious or spiritual reasons, they do it in Old Latin. So this is my name written in Latin. If you do it just for purely other reasons, they do it in Spanish. And I think that has to do with the Roman Catholic Church. If it's a religious reason, that's, yeah. So. But don't stop smelling those flowers. I was done. My friends were gone. I was sad because now I'm roaming the streets and I'm alone. And the streets that I had been walking around with my friends the day before, suddenly I'm walking the same streets and no more friends. It's quite a sad thing, but it's part of life. So look for the joyous things even in sad moments. Even when it's raining, I can't tell you how many times I have found that encouragement or that hope or that desire to keep moving for the better thing in the darkest situations, or when I'm raining, or frozen, or both. when I'm frozen, it's raining. Pardon me. The lodge, the last lodge, Roots and Boots. The pilgrims, they've come, they don't need their hiking sticks anymore. So you can buy the real fancy, expensive ones from the store, and those are just in a big bucket off out of frame. I picked up one of those and took it with me because I had more walking to do. But all these are the wooden ones that people have carried. Well, they can't take them on the plane, or they don't want them or need them anymore, so they leave them there. And this hostel has put them up as decorations. So I had actually brought this one here, almost as tall as the wall. Totally ridiculous, completely impractical. There's no need to carry a stick that tall at all. There's no purpose to it. But for 4 days I did, so I left it there. And this is Finisterre, Latin for the end of the earth. This was the end of the map in ancient times. There was no more known world. And then they crossed the English Channel, and there's England there. So they put that on the map. But this was the end. Columbus sailed from here. This was the end of the world. It's where he left. And this is where we finished. We went onto this hippie beach where people were dirty and sleeping in tents like hippies and cooking meals right there on the sand. And it was great. If you didn't want to pay for a hotel, sleep on the beach. They say don't swim. I swam. You're not supposed to swim. I got there at night in the dark, ran into some old friends at like 11. They're like, hey. So I walked with them, even though it was that late. And then I got down to the beach, and I asked if anybody was going in. And everybody said, maybe, maybe. I said, okay, well, I'm going in. And the sooner I go in, the sooner I get out and dry off. Well, I swam that night, and I swam the next day. And then I got to talking to people about just why it was so dangerous or what history it had. Well, a couple of years ago, four Italians went out there, and two of them didn't come back. They went swimming, and they got caught in a riptide, and it pulled them out to water, and two of them drowned before help could ever get to them, and the other two were strong enough swimmers that they managed to swim back to shore, but then the waves broke their bodies on the rocks, and they had broken arms and legs and were bleeding and had to be hospitalized, and they very nearly died. And I thought, oh, thanks, God. This is that picture. We are out of time now. I'm 5 minutes over. I have not told you that you must keep trying. You can't give up story yet. If you'd like to hear it, we can know it in questions and answers. And other than that, we have about a half hour. We'll take some questions.
Sure. Microphone over for you. If you would, if you have a question, please speak into the microphone.
Very easy. I just want to hear this story.
Okay. Weren't times tough? Didn't you have any hard times? Weren't there any difficulties in traveling? Well, yes. And if I would tell you anything about Europe, it's don't do anything on Sunday. Rest, relax, drink coffee, enjoy wine, conversation, eat some cheese. Don't travel. Nothing's open. Businesses are closed. Transportations are shut down. I went to this bus station in the morning. I was there 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. I needed a bus ticket to get out of this town because I was in Lisbon, which I had gone from Santiago de Compostela, or Finisterre, and then I'd gone back to Santiago, and then down through Porto, and Fatima, and Peniche and Baleal and then Lisbon. And in Lisbon, I spent, 3 hours walking around one place after another trying to get a bed for the night to sleep, and none of them would take me. So then another guy working there, he spent 45 minutes on the phone calling every fire station in the area, and he had a hard time getting me. He must have called 9-10 stations. He got me into this station. I finally had a bed for the night. And then now I'm at the point where I have to leave that place. So now there really is nowhere left in Lisbon to stay. I must go. It's not a question of do I want to or should I. It's I need to. So I go to this bus terminal at 9:10 in the morning. And they say, no, for tonight, no, we don't have tickets. You must come back. I say, okay. So I come back that afternoon. I couldn't come back at 1. It was a little bit later. I come back, and I go into the ticket office of the company I'm trying to buy my ticket from. And I find their office, and the door's locked. There's no one in there. There's a guy smoking over at this table there, and he says, oh, they're closed. I'm frustrated. I've walked several miles with everything I own on my back in the hot, blazing Spanish sun. It's been difficult to get this far. I can see, I can feel that that door is closed, so that this guy needs to tell me that they're not open. So instead, I asked him if I could join him to smoke. And he said sure he would, and we got to talking, and I got to know a little bit about him. And then was curious about what was going on, so I filled him in on my difficulties. And he says, "Well, they're closed. You're stuck." And I say, "No, I'm not stuck yet. I haven't even tried yet." He says, "Yes, but they're not open." I said, "Yes, but they're not the only ones." And he says, "Okay, well, could you spare a few euro? I need some, you know." He's, "Okay, well, maybe. I don't know." He says, "Oh, because I haven't eaten." And I said, "Yeah, neither have I. I haven't had anything to eat today either." And he says, "I don't know if I will have any money to eat." And I said, "I don't know if I will have money to eat." And he says, "I don't know where I, yes, I have a place to stay, but I don't have money." And I said, "I don't have a place to stay. I'm trying to get out of here because I might be sleeping on the street tonight. Oh, but can I have a few euro?" "Look, maybe. I don't know. I got to go check out this bus station. If you want to help me, you can." So to try to make a longer story short, I go to the next office, and they, no, it's not us. You need to go next door. He says, "Oh, see, you tried. It's no good." And I said, "No, you have to keep trying." I go to the next place, and they say, no, we have no tickets. And I said, "Oh." He says, "Oh, see, you have nothing." And so I said, "No, I'm not done yet." So I keep talking to him. He says, "Oh, somebody else is tonight after 8 p.m., and he's speaking Portuguese, and I'm speaking English, and there's not a lot of comprehension between the two of us, but there's going to be there somewhere, someone's coming in after 8 that might have more bus tickets." "Okay. I don't know if I can really wait." And he says, "Okay, that's it. You're stuck. You must wait." And I said, "No, I'm not done trying yet." And he says, "What do you mean?" I said, "You have to keep trying. You can't give up. You have to keep trying. You have to keep going." And he says, "Well, where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going this way." And he says, "Yeah, but can you give me those euros?" And I said, yeah, maybe. Just give me a minute. Let me just..." He says, "But that's..." He's trying to tell me, like, avoid me from even going there. I said, "Petrol station. Yeah, I know." I go in there, and I'm asking them if they speak English, if they know. He says, "Is there any camping around?" And they said, "Camping?" I said, "Yeah, I've got a tent. I don't have a hotel. Maybe I can just sleep in my..." He says, "No, there's no..." I said, "There aren't any parks or forests or hills or out-of-the-way landscapes?" And he says, "No, not around here." "Okay." And so now the guy says, "Now you are really stuck. You can go nowhere. You have no luck. You are without anything." And I said, "No, I have to keep trying. I can't give up." I said, "I understand that you feel that way, and that's fine. I get it. I'm not here to make you help me. I'm not here to have you figure it out for me. But I personally can't give up. I have to keep trying." And then I go to, and he says, yes, but can I have a couple of euros?" And I say, "Okay, look, man, train station's over there. I'm going over there. There's a spot in the shade. We'll stop. I'll see what I got for you. And then I got to check out this train." He says, "Okay." So we go over there, and I'm thinking in my head, okay, 2 euros, you know, that's not a big deal. Yeah, I haven't eaten. Yeah, that would give me some food for the day. But 2 euros, when you can give out of your poverty, you know you can give. Okay, I'll give this guy the first 2 coins that come out of my bag, because I had this little sunglasses bag full of euro coins. And so we get to that shady spot, and so I stop, and I reach down into that coin. I didn't pull it out. I didn't look at what I was doing. I just reached hidden into the bag, felt 2 coins in my hand, pulled them out, and they were a euro each. I thought, well, that's fitting. So I gave him 2 euros and a hug, and I told him good luck with his life and travels and everything. And then I went upstairs, and I found a train. And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, where's Faro? Map. Okay, pull out my map. Okay, I don't have Wi-Fi. I'm not paying for a cell phone either. I traveled the whole way just on Wi-Fi. No cell phone. So I'm looking at it, and I said, okay. Faro. Where's Faro? okay, way down south in Portugal. Can I zoom in? Are there any parks? No, I don't have Wi-Fi. I can't see. It's a fuzzy map. Okay, do I go? Do I not go? Well, I can't stay here. I know I can't sleep here. So even if I sleep on the street in Faro, you have to keep trying. You have to keep trying. And if that doesn't work, then you have to keep moving. You have to go somewhere else and try it there and see if that works. Sure enough, it did. I went to Faro. And long story short, I got a night to stay. And so the point of that story is just that that was when I really learned that it doesn't matter how difficult or frustrating or tired you are, you have to keep trying. You must keep trying. You must move to the next place if that's what it takes to keep trying, because it will work out.
Hi, I want to thank you. So how did you finance this? Yeah, they said you quit your job and, well, how did you do this?
Sure. There's a certain amount of just putting life to the wind. You know, we're all so involved in our lives, and we've all worked so hard to be where we are and to do the things we've done and have the things we have and live the way we do. You know, and it didn't happen overnight, and there is definitely a sense of sentimentality there. You know, you have a favorite band T-shirt. Imagine leaving everything. But I just realized that I was in a good place to travel. It was a good time. The bug was growing in me. It was a good time to separate from what I was doing and work because it wasn't making me happy. I sold everything I owned. I threw all caution to the wind, and I just went for it. I took anything I had saved up with me. I sold everything I could. I sold my Jeep when I run out of land to drive it on. And then I just tried to spend as little as humanly possible. And then before the trip was over, I ran out. So that was a very real thing on the Camino, knowing, well, I don't have any money, so maybe I'm not going to survive this Camino. But here I am, so obviously I did. And that's good, because it just teaches me, anyway, to put faith into what's possible. You may not have money for it. You may have a limited amount and go out and do it anyway and then run out of money, but it'll work out in the end. You'll be okay. I ate peanuts and gummy worms. That was my diet for the first week of the Camino. It was nothing but peanuts and sugar and coffee and cigarettes. And then people were very generous. There would be nights when all the pilgrims would be going to the big pilgrim dinner that cost 10 euro, which, first of all, that was at the time $16. I don't spend $16 to take myself out to a birthday dinner, let alone spend $16 on a pilgrim's menu. But very often I would go away at dinner time to bed or to a couch or to read my book or somewhere quiet and out of the way, and some other pilgrim would come find me and say, "Jeff, are you eating?" I say, "No, I can't pay for that dinner." And they say, no, you'll come. Come join us. There's food. And Portugal was very good for that. I think the Portuguese people are very open and very giving people. I was just trying to catch a ride, and instead of hitchhiking, the guy not only gave me a ride, but then took me to the hospital where his father was at and had just had open-heart surgery, introduced me to his family, then brought me to his father's home, gave me a home-cooked dinner, let me sleep in their own tent in their own backyard, use their toiletry, use their laundry machine, they washed my clothes, and then in the morning they gave me another meal, a couple of snacks, took me back out to the path and wished me well on my way. So you never know. I had no idea how much is out there, but until you put faith that it is out there and there is a way, then it does work out. And, you know, friends and family, you say I'm in a tight spot, and there are those close enough in your life that are nice enough or care enough about you, or in that particular moment in life, able to help you out. And maybe it's $100 or 200 or whatever, but sometimes that's the difference between having a bus ticket home and not having one, you know? So when you run out, I think friends and family. But then that's limited, you know? It's not like you're going to be able to call them up twice a week, every week for the rest of your life, asking them to keep helping you out. You're going to have to figure it out eventually. So that's what I'm here to do. Now that I'm home, I'm going back to work.
So how did it happen that you are in Ann Arbor? How did you get invited here and end up here?
Yeah, good question. I'd never been to Michigan before, but I've lived in Colorado for a long time, and I've met many people from Michigan, and they always seem like such nice people, such great people. And I keep wondering, what is it about Michigan that they're leaving behind, or what is it about Colorado that's so great they can't help but come over and see it? And then I had a friend here interested in the travel, interested in my coming home, and they were nice enough to extend an invitation to help me sort of land stateside and get back on my feet.
What would you say about yourself that changed the most important thing from your experience?
Good question. I definitely knew during the Camino and afterwards, as well as before then, but from then on for certain, that I knew coming home I wasn't going to be the same man I was when I left. And so maybe the most important thing, I don't know if there is one. I learned how to receive. I know when I left, that was a very difficult thing for me to receive. But all around the world, whether somebody was sharing a glass of wine with me, or they were having a home-cooked meal, or they were giving me a pilgrim's dinner on the Camino, learning to receive can be quite difficult. We have this sense of, I'm not poor, or I should be able to provide for myself, or, you know, I'm better than being in this unfortunate situation, or whatever. But so it's not always easy to accept things from others. And I think there was a great deal of learning in there, as well as I learned that even feeling in a state of poverty, even having no money and almost no possessions and just having the stuff on my back, a friend of mine encouraged me. She said, you still have so much to give. There is so much that you have to give other people, and maybe you just don't see it. And after she had told me that, I found that even in my poverty state, even in my almost no possessions to my name, there were still just frequently occurrences to help somebody out. Somebody wanted to make a phone call home. Well, I didn't have a phone, but I had Wi-Fi. They could use Facebook. You know, somebody else didn't have a power charger. Well, it's just like a small thing. I didn't really help him out that much, but his phone went from being dead and he had no charger to having a full charge and he could call home. And how to listen slowly. If I'm speaking with someone in another language and they don't speak English very well, then it helps them to be able to understand me if I keep my words smaller and slower and pronunciated. And they can't always speak English so quickly in return. And to be able to listen to them speak slowly, I would call that listening slowly. And on the other side of the spectrum, maybe it's somebody from New York, but they get on a plane and then a train and they got a hotel and then they went to the funeral and then they had a wedding and they had three kids and they all went to college and they're happily ever after. Get on with my day. I got a lot to do and I got stuff. I got places to be. Come on, hurry up and talk about it. Some people talk really fast. In Spanish, they call it machine gun Spanish. We're just as guilty of it. I'm just as guilty of it. I can speak quickly sometimes, but I would say learning to listen slowly not just helps with people from other languages, but it helps with other cultures, even within our own country, or other styles. Or a lot of times I find that we think, or at least I should only speak for myself personally, but I think I'll say something, and I think it's clear. I think it's understood. Come to find out, they have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about. That's where listening slowly comes in a little bit. Because then my most favorite phrase, my favorite word, what? What? I had a French guy. What? All the time. You would say something. What? It's because he didn't understand what you were saying. Okay.
You just touched on my topic a little bit, but how did you find communicating in all these countries where obviously you didn't know the local language?
Sure. First off, it's easier than I thought. More people speak English than I would have presumed. And there is a way of communicating with people non-verbally that regardless of what country you're in or what language they speak, you're still able to communicate certain fundamental basics. And I found that out in particular on the Camino. But how did I do it personally? Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi is almost everywhere, and you can very often find it free. And since I didn't have cell phone service, the internet was sort of my guide to everything. Google Maps, couch surfing, Workaway, Facebook. I showed up to Bali. I had no idea. I went through the security to exit Bali, and I thought, okay, cool. So then I round the corner, and I'm outside, and I asked to step back inside, and the security won't let me in. And well, they won't let me in because I've already left the airport. So now I've got to go through all my stuff in front of all these people. I'm in Bali, in Indonesia, in a place I've never been, surrounded by people who don't speak English. I don't know if I'm going to get robbed or mugged trying to get into my bag, but I have to in order to get my phone and my book and my contact information or whatever. And it worked out. I was trying to figure it out for more than an hour and a half there at the airport. I got into my stuff. I packed away everything else. I locked it up nice and secure so nothing could be stolen. I went upstairs. I found Wi-Fi. And then one of those blessings in life, my friend had messaged me, "Hey, where are you? We've been waiting to hear from you. Are you on the ground yet?" And I said, "Yeah, where are you?" He was an hour and a half north of there. There's no way I ever would have found out until Wi-Fi. And so then I was able to just jump in a cab, and there I was.
We're going to take a couple of more questions, and then we're going to have to end this. I want to remind you to please, if you get a chance, to fill out the evaluation. It really helps us to build programs for you guys. So any other questions? Well, let me bring this because we want to hear this on the recording.
What's next?
anything I set my heart on, I suppose. I don't necessarily have a next just yet. I'll have to come up with a way to pay for it first, I think. I've got a few questions that need answering still for some people home. But I've got a few ideas. I still didn't make it to Patagonia, which is where I had my heart set out from day one. I've always wanted and still do want to go to Patagonia. But I didn't know a way of getting there and surviving and coming back. So South America, and I haven't been to any of Africa. I haven't been to any of Asia. Southeast Asia in particular might be nice. Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam, Peru, I think. Europe again, for sure. I like Europe a lot. But, just wait until I'm ready and then go.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight.